Moolala is brought to you by the nonprofit credit counseling agency, Credit Canada. It's fair to say that money and risk are inextricably linked in so many ways. No risk, no reward. You've heard the phrase. So many of the decisions we make include an element of risk. They could be super obvious, like you're playing the slots in Vegas. Of course, you know, you're taking a risk. And there are things that we might describe as super safe bet, like, you know, buying a house. Well, it was safe until interest rates started their march higher and people realized that they actually did indeed take a risk when they bought that house. Elise Paysan-Lenestour has done extensive research on risk and on behavioral finance. She's an associate professor of finance at the University of South Wales in Sydney, and her research looks at the ways people perceive and react to financial risks. She joins us now from Australia to talk about her findings. Hello there.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me today.
It is our pleasure. You are on our radar in part because of a fantastic TED Talk you delivered a number of years ago on this broad topic. We will get into the details, but I first want to ask you how one even goes about approaching the study of risk. Do you go to Las Vegas, as I mentioned, and sit behind the retiree pulling a slot machine with a clipboard? Is that basically, did I just sum up your life's work in a sentence?
Oh, no, actually. Anthropologists do that. Natasha Schull is my favorite example. She did exactly what you've just described. No, what I do is, it's different. It's complementary. I do experiments in the lab. So I recruit human beings. I could do it with monkeys as well, but for now, just humans. And put them in the lab and have them participate in some risk-taking tasks, see how they behave, collect data, a lot of data, and then see whether interesting statistical behavioral patterns emerge, and then try to understand, to flesh out, you know, the root causes of what you observed.
What are some of the hypotheses that you're testing in your research? What are some of the questions that you're trying to answer?
So my recent research, what motivated me was to really try to understand the root causes of irrational risk-taking. What I mean by that is when you observe some seemingly puzzling behavior whereby the person who is, you know, purportedly intelligent, and yet the person is going to take reckless risks. That is, risks that are, I mean, taking gambles that are not worth the risks objectively. What I mean is you compute expected value, it's clearly negative, the risks are significant. And so you wonder, okay, why is this? I mean, why is this person taking a risk, exposing herself to massive losses? And it's not worth the risk objectively. And my motivation was to try to run experiments in the lab to uncover the root causes of this paradox.
What are some of the things that you found?
So what I found is that the usual suspect to explain why many of us actually sometimes take reckless risks is, so the usual suspect is what? Well, you said it at the beginning. It's faulty cognition, right? The fact that we are unaware of a true risk. So, you know, we are deluded that the risks are much, much smaller than actual. We are deluded that the expected value of what we're doing is positive, even when objectively it's not. And the usual suspect is very often, you know, the main reason why we are doing this. But what I discovered is that it is not the only reason that people engage in irrational gambling. Another reason is that we human beings, we are greedy and lack self-control. And what I mean by greed is, I refer to our neurobiology, the dopamine system of the human brain, makes us seek rewards. And something that I found, or I should say, it's not found, it's provided evidence for, is that in gambling context, we human beings, we may crave monetary rewards in the same way that we crave primary rewards such as food, for example. You know? So that's, I mean, an interesting, I think, finding because again, the usual, the standard explanation, which is, by the way, very valid, is that, well, you know, we don't understand what we're doing. Well, no, yes, but not sometimes this is not the reason why we're doing it. And here, the right analogy is diet. Many, if not most of us, we know how we should be eating to be healthy, yet we often succumb to binging on sugary foods. And my research suggests that, well, in financial investing, it may well be the same thing, which is...
How do you factor in neurodiversity? And I ask because a neurotypical human would have certain behaviors that probably hover around the mean. And there are people who have ADHD, for example, and they have impulsive behavior that... that affects them in life in so many ways, in terms of what they say out loud when it may not be appropriate, in terms of how fast they drive a car or jump off a diving board. And we see in the nonprofit credit counseling world, a lot of people who take risky steps with their money have a root cause that is connected to neurodiversity, or another example would be mental health. How do you factor that in to your findings?
Also, that's, so you're spot on. That's very important, actually, to understand that there's a massive inter-individual heterogeneity. That is, we are not equally vulnerable to a plague that I've just mentioned, this craving thing. And that's a very important point to make indeed. So what I mean is, and I like that you mentioned the ADHD example. So, because as you know, it's something that is fairly common in a population, but so it's not abnormal in that sense. It's not like, you know, a disease, not at all. It's and so somebody exhibiting, you know, ADD syndrome is more susceptible to the craving thing, while somebody who is whose makeup is different in the sense that, just to give you a funny example, so I am OCD, so meaning that it's, you would say, well, to summarize, it's a bit simplistic, but you would say it's a symmetrical of ADD in the sense that you tend to be super, well, not impulsive, but quite the reverse, you know? So you would really be super rigid, but paying in attention to focusing for hours with no problem. And so anyway, so meaning that the CEO of my brain, my prefrontal cortex, is pretty good at controlling things. And I'm a big control freak, by the way. So compared to the typical ADD person, it's quite the opposite. Part of the issue with ADHD is that the CEO of the brain is not fully able to control things. And so that's, you know, so somebody with ADHD person is going to be way more vulnerable to the greed factor that I described before, relative to somebody like me. So I would be significantly less susceptible to the plague. So moral of the story is that self-awareness is really important, because so what I mean is talking about the average person, which, by the way, I did at the beginning when I talked about this grid thing and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, okay, on average, but self-awareness is key because, again, some of us are more vulnerable than others.
Another dimension that I want to layer in and get your take on is one's lived experience. So you could have a young person who grew up in deep poverty, and as they move forward in their life, they behave in a way that is maybe very risk averse because of the circumstances of their upbringing, or very risk tolerant because they're like, what do I have to lose here? I may as well just throw it all at the wall because it can't get any worse than it was when I was 12. What do you observe in the way people were parented and the way they were raised in those formative years?
So what recent research suggests, not mine, by the way, because I don't, I mean, I didn't research on that topic, but from reading the literature, yeah, I think the most insightful field is the epigenetics, in genomics. The recent there has been a revolution recently, in the sense that the take home message is that our genetic code per se is not that important, because what matters the most is your early life experiences, the environment in which you were grown. And so the idea being, just to explain it intuitively, basically your body is going to adjust to the predicted environment. So if it's as if metaphorically your body can anticipate, oh, in which world am I gonna live in? And so imagine that early on in life, just to follow up on your example, so the individual lives in a, in an environment that is characterized by a lot of poverty, so let's say deprivation, and then the body's gonna adjust to that by anticipating, oh gosh, it's gonna be tough. And this could trigger modifications in gene expression, in the sense that, for example, this is a hypothesis, but that's, I mean, what has been suggested by recent work, that could make the agent, for example, more risk tolerant, in the sense that if there is a reward opportunity that crops up, it may be rational for the agent to just, jump at all risks, because again, if a body has anticipated that, oh boy, I'm gonna live in it's gonna be, total deprivation, I do need to find out reward sources to survive, and so that could trigger changes in the genetic makeup of the individual, in the sense that gene expression is gonna be modified in such a way that, in my example, the agent is gonna be more risk tolerant, and so that's one way to summarize this epigenetic dynamic. So if you want, it's about really like reprogramming our genes such that we are adapted to our current environment, the environment we live in. That's basically how how it works.
I want to ask one last question before we go. I am fascinated by all this. It's like intellectual candy for me. And as an academic, you can pursue questions really for the pursuit of the question and the knowledge and the insight. But there is also so much in what you research and what you write about that is incredibly applicable to the average human in terms of understanding themselves and, at best, modifying behavior in a way that serves their future self. If you were to, this is an impossible question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. If you were to boil all of this down into one takeaway that you would wrap up and gift to our listeners as a piece of advice that they could apply, what would it be?
I think it would probably be, if we're talking to financial investors, I would say don't focus too much on what you're going to be told by some behavioral finance people telling you that, oh, you know, people are stupid. So the reason that you take insane risks often is because it's lack of intelligence. And don't just be aware that, you know, there are other reasons. And I would like people to focus more on the, you know, this greed thing and this. I think it's an important idea that often we do silly things in terms of, you know, risk taking. It simply reflects how our brain was wired. It's about our neurobiology, and we can do something about it so long as we are aware of that. And again, here, I like the food analogy because I believe it's highly relevant here. Again, we, you know, many of us, we know what we should be doing, yet we often succumb to binging. And it's the same thing in financial investing. And I do believe that this very simple idea is not something that is well known, because again, both behavioral finance research in the past, and also I shall add pop psychology notions as well, converge towards this idea that, oh, you know, people will be stupid. It's like, you know, this Homer Simpson, you know, picture. And
yeah.
I would say, wait. It is often true, but definitely not always. And there are other root causes as to why we take insane risk. And I would like people to focus bit more on, you know, this aspect, the greed.
Very helpful. The greed. Oh, I'm afraid that's our time, Elise. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Many thanks for your interest in the research.
Merci. Elise Pézanne-Nestour is an associate professor of finance at the University of South Wales in Sydney. She joins us today from Australia in a very different time zone.